May it please the court. I'm here today to ask the court to correct what I believe is an error in the law. And the error is the exclusive causal standard that's currently applied to claims for workers' compensation retaliation and discrimination that was created by this court in Hansom versus Northwestern in 1984. And that's point one of our brief. And I'm asking that Hansom be overruled and that the later case in 98, Crabtree versus Bugby, be overruled, and that the instruction in MAI that currently requires exclusive causation in the third paragraph be overruled or be changed.
Have we been trending after the brilliant decision by Chief Justice Russell and the, I think it's close to McDonough, the discrimination case that said it didn't have to be an exclusive discrimination could be exclusive, it can be contributory. Are we trending to more to that standard than the older standard?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think you're referring to the Fleshner case that dealt with the public policy exception.
Which is also Judge Russell's case.
Well, and I think that we are, and that's part of the reason that we asked the court to accept transfer of this case and reexamine the standard. I think that Hansom was wrong when it was decided. I think that the statute never contained language requiring exclusive causation. It doesn't contain it now.
Counsel, that presents a very interesting question of American jurisprudence. Assume that you're correct that the statute did not provide for that method of causation and that that court was wrong in 1984. It appears to me that Judge Holstein, assuming the legislature was unknowing or unaware of that decision, it looked like Judge Holstein teed it up pretty good in 1998 and had this jurisprudential question about what do we do if they're wrong. And at some point in time, we have to assume that the policymakers, which could amend this statute to make it clear that it's exclusive or motivating or contributing, we assume that they know what our cases say. And then nothing happened in 98. And then in 2005 and in 2008, we've had some pretty substantial revisions to the workers' compensation law. So as a court, assuming that we agree with you that it was wrong in 1984, what are we to do with the fact that the legislature who gets to make that policy decision has chose not to?
Well, that's obviously a difficult issue from my position, and I acknowledge it. But I think that this court's recent cases have also recognized that action or inaction by the legislature is a factor to be considered, but it's not the determining factor. And I think that if you balance what factors can be considered, it weighs in favor of change. They might not have considered it. But
action by the legislature specifically addressing the issue, despite what you might read into it from inaction from time, but action by the legislature specifically addressing the issue is very pertinent to what we do, isn't it?
It is. But I think that it's one of the factors to be weighed, and I think that the other factors outweigh it. And I think that one of the problems that we can't get around here is that we have a statute that is supposed to prohibit discrimination. And that's why it's there. And it doesn't. And it allows it, and it condones it, because discrimination or a prohibited motive can be a contributing factor in the employment decision. It can be a motivating factor in the employment decision. It can be the primary factor in the employment decision. And the employee is not protected if it's not the exclusive factor. And that problem was recognized by Judge Russell in the Court of Appeals opinion in 98.
Is there a difference where a statute is ambiguous and this court interprets it and the legislature doesn't change it? One can infer that ambiguity was properly resolved. But if the statute doesn't say something, can we add words to it, and by the legislature not enacting something, do we treat the failure to enact legislation as if it were legislation? In other words, can you look at the legislature's failure to respond in the face of an unambiguous statute which simply does not say what our case said it said? Is that a different situation?
I think it is. I mean, I don't think The statute doesn't contain the terms. It doesn't. It's not ambiguous, and it contains language that the court has consistently found requires a different standard, a different causal standard, contributing factor standard in this case. In public policy cases, the rule that was announced in Fleshner was if an employee is terminated for exercise or for reporting violations of the law or for refusing to violate the law, that a contributing factor causal standard occurred. And in this case, the statute says no employer shall discriminate or discharge against an employee for exercising their rights under the workers' compensation statute. And the legislatures in the states that apply the exclusive causation standard in work comp retaliation cases have statutes that say solely for and exclusively for. And even the federal courts that the defendant and the amicus briefs want to rely on for a heightened standard or for keeping the exclusive causation standard now recognize that you cannot use exclusive cause in situations where that language is not in the statute. And I cited a Sixth Circuit case in the brief where the language was because, and they recognize that it's an outdated view that it be exclusive cause, and that if it's a factor, it can be actionable and can be discrimination.
But you acknowledge that Fleshner did not say in workers' compensation cases that the standard should be a contributing factor, and that was clearly a public policy exception. And there's a difference between those types of cases and a workers' comp case, which purpose of the workers' comp statute is to provide for redress and injury for injured employees. Help me get to why in workers' comp cases we should extend this contributing factor causation to those types of cases.
Well, there's a couple reasons. The first one is the statutory language. I mean, the
there is no language.
In the workers' comp setting?
There's no for causation.
Well, but it has the language for, which, you know, it implies there must be a causal standard, and that's what...
Can you quote the language again? The language for, what is it?
From the statute?
Uh-huh.
It's no employer shall discharge or in any way discriminate against an employee for exercising his or her rights under the workers' compensation mm-hmm. statute. Okay?
Does that, that imply exclusivity outside of our opinion?
I'm sorry?
Would that imply exclusivity?
No.
Outside of our opinion?
I don't believe it implies exclusivity. I want to make this point, go back to the original interpretation by the court in Hansom. I mean, I've looked at all those cases and thought about the basis of that decision. And the court in that decision, and maybe in 98, was facing situations where employees were filing lawsuits and saying, I filed a work comp claim, and then I was discharged. And so I should be protected from discharge. And the concern, obviously, was there has to be a causal connection. You can't just file a work comp claim and then be protected from discharge and be guaranteed employment. And so that was the atmosphere that the court was working under at the time. And that was what the plaintiff was trying to do in Mitchell, which was the first court of appeals case that Hansom looked at. There was nothing pled on causation. There was nothing pled with respect to discrimination. It was just absent from the case altogether. And so the court said, well, there has to be a causal connection. If you look at Mitchell and you look at the cases that Mitchell relies on, there's a case from Texas that Mitchell cites to say this is a case, factually, where there is substantial evidence of discrimination by the employer. And in that case that it's citing to, the plaintiff was injured and was assigned light work duty by his employer, and his employer put him back to work, lifting a couple things that he wasn't supposed to be lifting, really kind of pushing him, and then required him to be at work one day at 6 a.m. in the morning. He didn't show up until 9 a.m. because he had taken some pain pills and he overslept. When he got to work, the employer fired him, and he fired him for being late. And so that's a reason that it's not retaliation for work comp discrimination. And that court found that that's evidence of discrimination, and the Mitchell court referenced that as substantial evidence of discrimination.
Can you get back to my question?
I'm sorry.
It's okay. You know, help me get from why contributing factors should now be applied to workers' comp as it has been in some of these other types of cases.
Because exclusive causation cannot any longer be justified in view of the language of the statute, the trending of the cases, the court's recognition that discrimination is often proven by indirect or circumstantial evidence, and the fact that discrimination occurs if the illegal motive is a part of the employment decision, which in Fleshner, you know, the court refers to as reprehensible regardless of the other actions of the employer. There is no distinction to me between statutory causes of action and the common law public policy cause of action, because the MHRA is a statute and contributing factor standard applies in cases under the MHRA. So I have thought about it and thought about it and cannot think of a reason other than it's been decided that workers' comp retaliation should not have the standard that is applied in our other employment cases. I don't think it was justified at the time it was decided. I don't think it's justified by the language of the statute. I don't think it's justified by the trends of this court's case law that has developed after the Hansom and after the Crabtree decision, and it results in situations where employees like my client, Mr. Templemeyer, are discharged and they have no recovery. And he's a good worker who was doing the work that he was supposed to do. His supervisor said he was a good worker, and the owner of the company was ridiculing this injury, making him drive heavy trucks in order, and it was aggravating his foot injury, and then discharged him because he was taking a 15-minute break that was required by his work comp doctor, which the employer referred to as him milking his injury. And he can sue him for whatever he wants for. That's why he pays the lawyers, but he can't recover. And so what's the statute there for? I think it's meaningless if it doesn't, if you don't bring the standard in line with the causal standard that applies in our other wrongful termination cases.
Counselor?
Yes.
Would you agree that the legislature does get to make the decision regarding causation as it relates to these types of cases?
Yes. If it's a statutory cause of action, I understand that they can write the causal standard in the statute.
So the real issue in this case is if the court was wrong, as you argued back then, what, if any, deference at all we give to the fact that that this standard has been in play for around 20 years?
I acknowledge the cases that say that legislative inaction is something to be considered. Mm-hmm. I think that the court can just as well rely on cases that say that legislative inaction is not the determining factor. For example, the medicine mm-hmm. shop case from this court, where the court said the General Assembly's inaction has sometimes been interpreted to be approval of the court's reading of the statute. However, it could just as well mean that forces in favor of changing law are matched by forces against it. For these reasons, it's speculative to infer legislative approval from legislative inaction.
So I guess in your view of the way that our system of justice should work, rather than just teeing the issue up like Judge Holstein, that if this court believes that the original decision was wrong, just reverse it and then see if that tees the issue back up for the legislature.
Yes, because you have to interpret statutes the way that they're written, and we got to do that across the board in all cases. And I think that if the statute is interpreted, the interpretation, I think, violates the rules of statutory construction, and it is the job of the court to interpret the statutes as written. And it's not being interpreted as written. If this court does what we ask and overrules those prior decisions and interprets the statute as we believe it should be, which is to allow for a contributing factor, and the legislature disagrees, I have no doubt that they will try to amend it.
And the legislature has not chosen to reverse both of Judge Russell's decisions. I forget the name of the one, which is a discrimination case with the either the
Doherty
or the firefighter. What?
Doherty,
that's
Fleshner.
The one. Doherty or Fleshner. The legislature has not chosen to reverse those decisions, that we can apply something from that.
And I see my time is up.
Thank you. You'll have 3 minutes on rebuttal. Mr. Buckley.
May it please the court. I can't help but note in passing that 50 years ago last Saturday, I was in this courtroom sworn in as a member of the bar.
All right.
It's been a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to work with gentlemen like that are on this case.
And from now on, you don't have to pay bar dues. So
that's
a good
thing. Let me get right to it. I think the question in this case is, what was the intent of the legislature when it enacted 287780? Because I think that is the fundamental inquiry of this court in making a determination in this case as to whether or not we continue to apply Crabtree and Hansom, or whether or not we're going to redefine the nexus between the prohibited conduct on behalf of the employer and this compensable injury sustained by the employee. So I think it's important to look at the time in 1984 to determine what the legislature, what the causation factor was in effect at that time. Clearly, it was but-for causation. Clearly, it was not a contributing factor.
But for is not exclusive. Those are totally different.
It's not exclusive. That's correct. Okay. But the but for causation standard was what was in place at that time, as was the employment at will doctrine. So when the legislature enacted 287780, it enacted the statute in the light of the employment at will doctrine, and also in connection with the but for causation standard, which was in effect at that time. The court had to presume, I think, that the legislature had to presume that the courts would adhere to the traditional principles of causation and require the employee to prove that but for exercising his rights granted under the statute, that he would not have been discharged. If the legislature had disagreed with that standard or anticipated that standard would not have been implemented, then it certainly could have incorporated a lesser standard in the statute, as is suggested by the appellant.
Now, don't we have a principle that you can't assume the law won't change? I mean, in other contexts, no one can presume. You have no vested right in the law staying as it is at the time of you do anything.
Well, I think that's correct. Certainly we can presume that the law can change and will change, but I think the question is, what did the legislature intend at the time that the statute was drafted and enacted? Judge Billings in Hansom said that the Workers' Compensation Act provides a limited exception to the at-will doctrine. And he said, went on to say, absent a statutorily prohibited reason for discharge, in this case, an exclusive causal relationship between the discharge and the employee's exercise of his rights, the employer is free to fire an employee at will. Hansen made certain that the employment at will doctrine and the statute be read together. Again, Judge Billings said, no words in 287780 express any intent to abolish the common law of employment at will for those who have filed a workers' compensation claim. Appellant urges this court to abolish the exclusive causation standard and adopt the contributing factor standard first announced in Doherty versus Maryland nearly 30 years after the 287780 was enacted. As Judge Holstein noted in Crabtree, if there is an injustice or an absurdity, it would be for this court to abandon the requirement that the discharge be exclusively caused by the exercise of rights pursuant to the workers' compensation rule. And he went on to say that under that rule, an employee that could be discharged for cause, for absenteeism, for incompetence, if he could persuade a fact finder under a lesser standard.
Now, we're supposed to assume that the legislature knows what it's doing. Of course we will. So that as we look at different discrimination laws, we look at the brilliant Doherty case and the Fleischer cases. We have different discrimination laws in the state of Missouri, and I know the legislature knows what it's doing, but they have different standards for what's discrimination from one case to the other. And there were a number of cases when the Fleischer was handed down, I dissented, but that were at will and not at will were treated separately. In fact, sometimes at will doctrine employees are given more rights than people who aren't at will, especially around discrimination issues. So it's sort of a rhetorical question. So I assume we just go along with what the legislature specifically stated. It was cited earlier on Hansen and Crabtree. Even though the laws have changed, not a discrimination laws regarding different issues.
Correct. I think I understand.
That's the right answer.
Counsel, if I could also ask you about the statute. Does it contain the word exclusive or sole? Does the statute, has it ever contained the word exclusive?
The statute has never contained the words exclusive. The statute has never contained the word sole.
Judge White said in his dissent in Crabtree, the exclusive language in Handsome appears to have been plucked out of thin air. Where did it come from? Did it come from thin air, or if not, where did it come from?
I think it came as a result of the court attempting to balance the rights of the employer in the employment at will with the rights of the employee to be free from discrimination.
Are we free to add words to a statute?
And so the court added the word exclusive to the statute and could very well have said that the but-for causation apply in this case, but it did not. It chose to use the word exclusive.
And so since that time, since Crabtree, and now we've got Daugherty and Fleschner, and they say a contributory factor in public policy violation cases, why shouldn't this workers' compensation case be treated with the same causation standard as public policy violations? Why are they different?
They're different because, number one, Fleschner is common law. It's a cause of action that is granted under common law. Daugherty is different. Daugherty interprets a statute. The question is, I think, did the legislature intend that a lesser standard be employed as the court decided it should do in the civil rights statute, under the civil rights statute, some 30 years later? And what I'm saying is there is no way that the legislature, given the state of the law and the way the court's interpretation of causation at that time, there is no way that the court could have presumed that a lesser standard would have been employed, or at least if it did, it certainly had never heard of the contributing factor standard because it wasn't born until Daugherty.
But you're in effect saying they codified the common law as it existed 30 years ago, and there's no case that says that. There's no principle that says that. The common law, whatever the standard of causation is not set by statute unless the statute specifically sets it out. It's a matter of common law. The legislature cannot take from the court its ability to determine issues under the common law unless by a specific statute that's directed to that purpose. Here, the statute, as you said, as everybody acknowledges, doesn't directly speak to causation. So how can it limit the court to exclusive causation, which is nowhere in any statute, or how can it limit this court's ability to, under the common law, determine what the proper standard of causation is? I'm not clear. You're in effect saying that the legislature, by not setting out a standard of causation back when it enacted the statute 30 years ago, prohibited this court from addressing whether there's appropriate changes in the common law standard of causation.
No. What I'm saying is that the legislature was aware of the court and the causation standard employed by the court.
And you're saying every statute we have to assume whatever the common law was at that time, we have to assume the legislature liked it and we can't change it. I mean, that's in effect what you're saying.
You know, I can't say that in every case that's true. I think you have to be, to some extent, you have to look at the environment that has existed at that time and what did the legislature intend. Now, if we want to say that times change, and by virtue of times changing, by virtue of different decisions by this court in other cases, a lesser standard is applicable, then that is a change in the concept of the causation that was not in place at the time the legislature passed the statute.
So do you disagree with Daugherty?
I don't disagree with Daugherty, and I don't think Daugherty is necessarily applicable to this case because, as I said, it was the birthplace for a contributing factor.
Well, let me stop you right there. Contributing factor was approximate cause in the MAI as soon as I got out of law school, right? That was a long time ago. It may have been the first time that principle, which
cause
had been in the MAI,
to cause.
Yeah, had been in the jury instructions, approved jury instructions for years relative to other types of causes of action. Not every statutory cause of action has the forethought to add a causation clause, and that's why we got this problem here, right? That no matter what word is used to determine causation, there isn't one in the statute. We all agree to that. The issue is what one is plugged in. But back to Daugherty, isn't the reason that that language was used there is because that's the language that lawyers and courts were used to seeing in the approved instructions as it related to proximate cause.
I cannot address that question as to what the reasoning of the court was when it adopted contributing factor in Doherty. I think they are different types of cases. Civil rights cases are different. And there's been a body of civil rights development in the common law as well as in statutory law since this workers' compensation 780 was enacted.
Let me say, I think Judge Fisher was in part saying our jury instructions have long said contributed to cause is sufficient to find for the plaintiff. Something caused or contributed to cause.
Cause or contributed that's another, to cause.
That's not but-for causation. That's contributed to cause. So why would the legislature think there would be some higher standard implied?
If contributed to cause were used in this case, it would certainly be different than a contributing factor, because a contributing factor could be as little as, well, this guy has got, he's been a malingering for 10 years, he's had workers' compensation claims, take that scenario, and the man, and he never shows up for work, and so I'm going to fire him because he is absent from work without cause. Now, there is a reference to the workers' compensation as a contributing factor for a positive result. And I say that the purpose of this statute is to balance the rights of the employer and the employee. Both of these entities have a right, and that right is A, the employee to be free from discrimination, and B, the right of the employer to run his business as he sees fit, as he chooses to do so, without interference from others and from outside influences. So as a consequence, you know, I think really the bottom line in this case is really pretty simple, and that is, in this case, the appellant is asking the court to introduce a lesser standard so as to prevent recovery. Now, you take this case, and in this case, the employee testified in a deposition given in another case when he was asked why was he discharged. He said, because I didn't do a job that the employer asked me to do, insubordination, which is what the employer pleaded as an affirmative defense, insubordination. He went on to say, oh, later on in the deposition, well, I was fired because I filed a work comp claim. But the important thing is, the absurd result is what if a lesser standard were employed in this case and the jury had a lesser standard to determine liability, the employer would in effect be saying, even though I was insubordinate, even though I failed to do a job that the employer asked me to do, I should still be able to recover because...
So you would say if the jury believed the employee's evidence that he had to rest for 15 minutes because of his injury for which he'd received work comp and under doctor's orders had to raise it periodically, that would still be insubordination and he could be fired for that?
But that's an issue in the case.
Yeah, no, I understand, but that's what I thought you were arguing.
Well, no, I wasn't arguing that. Okay. No, not at all.
I'd like to hear your comment relative to the one standard that nobody's talked about here today, which is the motivating factor standard. That sometimes
motivating factor standard, as raised by Amicus in one of the briefs, would be perhaps a better standard to use than just the contributing factor, because contributing factor, there's no measure of causation there. What is contributing factor? It's got to be something that at least moves the employer to take the action to discharge the employee or to sanction the employee for his conduct. Motivating factor at least has some sense to it. Whereas I think contributing factor in this situation, given the fact that we've got an employment at will doctrine, given the fact that it's completely different than the civil rights cases, I think motivating factor does have some substance, does have some sense to it. Let me just say, I know my time, I've got 10 seconds to say that when this court adopted MAI 201 and the pretext instruction is totally useless to a jury in determining the results of this case, or any case, because as far as I know my time's up, but let me just finish one sentence, and that is that the contributing factor is nothing but an embellishment of MAI 201, and an embellishment of 201 is not necessary because the instruction as Judge DeVilbiss, as Professor DeVilbiss taught us in law school, and he was the first reporter for MAI, he said, the framework of the instructions is to allow the lawyers to develop the facts under the evidence and the law as given by the court, and we shall not continue to embellish the instructions. That's been the law this court has followed ever since, and I ask the court to follow it now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Beckley.
Counselor, while you're on the way up to the podium, if there, I'd like to hear your take on the issue of whether or not motivating factor would be a substitute that would protect both the employer and the employee and be in line with what the legislature intended, either then or now.
I believe that motivating factor would be better than exclusive causation. I do not believe that motivating factor would be appropriate, and I do not believe that motivating factor has any basis in Missouri law under our wrongful termination claims. And here's why. In Fleschner, I think that the court all but expressly rejected the motivating factor standard. And it spoke about the MHRA, and it spoke about the public policy exception, and it spoke about how the actions of the employer are no less reprehensible if the prohibited conduct is part of the employment decision. And so a motivating factor standard would allow it to be more than part. I mean, if it was just part, if it was a contributing, I suppose then the employee would not be able to recover, and that would allow what this court has described as reprehensible conduct. And I cannot figure out how to distinguish MHRA cases and public policy cases from workers' compensation cases.
Well, as we're quoting law professors, my law professor at in my law school said, following Paul's graph, Long Island Railroad, proximate cause means everything to everyone and means nothing to anyone. So we use that all the time, but for the life of me, I don't understand all these instructions that well. Given proximate cause is the general accepted causation for almost everything.
And I think that any decision that involves, that is in any way based upon something that's prohibited, is discrimination. And so if we do motivating factor, we're going to allow some level of it. The defendant and the amicus speak it in terms of a lower burden, but what does that really mean? That means there's some level of discrimination that the employee should be subjected to before they are able to recover. And I don't think the statute calls for that. And with respect to seeking, I was thinking of a case, Judge Fisher, when you asked me. The medicine shop case says, in addition to seeking legislative change of an incorrectly interpreted statute, a party in a subsequent case may ask the court to reexamine and overrule its previous case. And so that's what I'm asking to do now. And I don't think that there's ever been language to support exclusive causation. I don't think Hansom had cases to support it. And I think that it was reexamined in Crabtree. I don't agree with the view. I think that you have to be able to protect employees who have claims for workers' compensation discrimination, and theoretical concerns about employees who may file faulty claims should not outweigh the rights of employees who have real claims and who have exercised their rights to be able to come to the courthouse and vindicate those rights when they're retaliated against by their employers.
Was contributing factor a recognized standard of causation at the time the statute was adopted?
Well, if it was, I don't remember seeing those words. There had to be a causal connection. And so
the question I have is clearly you talk about trending, and that is a recognized causation standard now. But was it an existing standard the legislature could have intended to adopt? And if it was not recognized at that time, how can we interpret the statute that that's the standard they intended?
Well, I think it had to be recognized at the time, because if the prohibited motive was a contributing factor in the employment decision, then there was a causal connection. And that's what the statute calls for.
And so what kind of cases recognized contributing factor at the time this statute was adopted? So well, that, because there clearly isn't, I think it, I think you concede the statute doesn't state what the standard is.
I think the court can look to the cases that Hansom relied upon. And I think the court can look to the Mitchell case and the factual scenario I talked about earlier. The case that Mitchell, which is the court that Hansom relied upon, said, hey, here is substantial evidence of discrimination. And that factual scenario was a contributing factor scenario because the employee was fired for being late. And so that was a legitimate reason. And so his claim would have been precluded under exclusive cause. But discrimination was a contributing factor because the other evidence in the case was that the employer was unhappy about what happened, had forced the employee to do things that his doctor might not have otherwise required. And then that's part of the reason that he was fired. He was mad about the work comp claim. And so even then, back when in 1984 the cases relied upon recognized that as the causal connection of discrimination under the statute as it was written at that time.
Thank you, counsel. Matter will be taken under submission.